Good morning. Welcome to Jays Talk Plus Playoff Edition. We didn't get those last year, technically. We did a Friday show teeing up the wild card series, and then by the time Monday rolled around, Toronto Blue Jays were eliminated. That is hopefully not going to be the case this year. Regardless, we get shows anyway. The Toronto Blue Jays clinched a wild card berth Saturday night while I was at the back of a concert looking at the Mariners-Rangers game on a phone screen to make sure the Jays had punched their ticket. The Jays, of course, lost on Saturday. So, sure, you could say back their way in. They had one of the strongest finishes to the season if we look at the last 5 or 6 weeks. But, yeah, losing and punching your ticket that way always feels a certain way. Losing yesterday and then celebrating feels a certain way. But they did what they were supposed to do, asterisk. They did not do what the expectation was entering the season, which was compete for a division title and hopefully avoid your season coming down to a best 2 out of 3. But recognizing that that is very difficult to do, and Tampa Bay and Baltimore had very good seasons, they at least got to the dance. They finished the season with 89 wins, so right in line with what they did the last 2 years when they won 92 and 91. They are the third wild card, which some people would tell you is better than the second wild card because it means a date with the Minnesota Twins instead of the Tampa Bay Rays, and drawing into a side of the bracket that has the Houston Astros rather than the Baltimore Orioles. There is room for a reasonable disagreement about both of those things. We will spend today's show and tomorrow's show going through a lot of Minnesota Twins things as we set this wild card series up. If you didn't catch it yesterday on social media, the schedule goes as follows. Tuesday, 4:38 p.m. Eastern time, first pitch. We will, of course, have that for you on Sportsnet Television, on the Sportsnet Radio Network, on the Sportsnet app. Wednesday, 4:38 start time as well. Thursday is penciled in as 4:38. I would not lock that into your calendar because that game time can swing all over the place depending on how many game threes there are on Thursday. Obviously, if there are fewer, then Major League Baseball is going to want to flex these around to maximize viewership. But Tuesday and Wednesday, 4:38 p.m., we anticipate game one being Kevin Gausman against Pablo Lopez. We anticipate game two being Jose Berríos or Chris Bassett against Sonny Gray. The Jays haven't indicated either way what order they might do those two in, although both are available. Berríos is the guy who on turn would go game two. And then game three would be whichever Bassett or Berríos is not used in game three against, we think maybe Joe Ryan. But if I'm Minnesota and given what the Jays have hit well and have struggled with, I maybe lean Bailey Ober there. Although there's also the consideration of, you know, who has more utility out of the bullpen or familiarity out of the bullpen. The Jays anticipate, we think, using Yusei Kikuchi out of the bullpen for this series and then returning him to the rotation if the playoffs continue on such that they need another starter. We'll be teeing all this stuff up today. We'll be teeing all this stuff up tomorrow. Procedurally, a note that it is Wildcard Media Day in Minnesota later this afternoon. So you'll see a bunch of stuff on social media from your Sportsnet personalities. You'll have Ben, Shai, whoever else writing things up for Media Day. It's kind of just a full day of rolling media availabilities. We'll get some important updates on the health status of Minnesota Twins as well, I'd imagine. Carlos Correa, Royce Lewis. The latest didn't sound like Byron Buxton was on his way back. Maybe we get confirmation to that today. If you were looking for wildcard rosters, they do not have to be out until 10 a.m. tomorrow. So tomorrow's show will start with a wildcard roster reveal of sorts, and we'll break that down. We'll also spend a lot of today's show taking a look at what that roster could and should look like. One other procedural note before we get going here. It is also Toronto Raptors Media Day. Masai Ujiri is speaking right now as I come on. That's a tough head-to-head for me, but we could do it. This is playoff time. If you are looking for more Raptors Media Day content on the Sportsnet Radio Network or on the podcast side, the Raptors show with William Liu and Alex Wong is coming to you after me live from down at Media Day. So they'll be 12 to 2. You can listen on radio. You can check out the podcast as usual. They'll be joined live by OG Anunoby and Jakob Poeltl at some point during that show. So that should be a lot of fun. Also a lot of fun standing at the back of a concert venue watching the Texas Rangers eliminate the Seattle Mariners with your pal and our next guest, Jonah Bierenbaum of The Score. Jonah, good morning. How are you, buddy?
Good morning, bud. Doing very well, thank you.
So yeah, that's the big story of the weekend. The Blue Jays lose on Saturday, and then we're seeing Rat Boys at the Monarch Tavern, and we've got a little game up on our screen. Not something you want to do during the set of a band you really enjoy and really respect, but had to do it to them. The Jays clinch, and obviously yesterday's game was mostly a nonsense game, and we're more out of town scoreboard watching than anything else. Let's start with a vibe check. How are you feeling as the Jays officially in there now as wild card three with an 89 win season under their belt?
You can't not be optimistic at this point. As frustrating and as maddening as the regular season was, all of that kind of goes out the window once you make it to October, which the Blue Jays, in spite of themselves, have done. And I think at this point, since they actually did manage to clinch a postseason berth, I think it warrants, you know, sort of looking at the season through another lens, which is to say, as frustrating as it was, and as ultimately unspectacular as it was, they had an objectively solid season. 89 wins, a plus 75 run differential. Those aren't numbers to sneeze at. Yes, it definitely fell short of expectations, and at no point did the Blue Jays look especially dominant. But again, I think that underwhelming feeling is a function of the fact that expectations were extremely high coming into the year. Everyone expected them to compete for a division title. Obviously, that didn't happen. But having said that, you know, they played winning baseball every month of the season except for May. They had a positive run differential every month of the season except for one. Like I said, they didn't look dominant at any point, but given the strength of their run prevention, they really managed to avoid any particularly ugly stretches. You know, they're a good team. They're not, I think it's safe to say, an elite team. But you don't need to be an elite team to win the World Series. Just ask the 2015 Kansas City Royals or the 2014 San Francisco Giants or the 2011 St. Louis Cardinals or the 2006 St. Louis Cardinals, a team that barely finished 500 during the regular season. So they're a solid team. Plus, they landed the first round opponent that was overwhelmingly preferred, certainly by the fan base, with cause, I would argue, given the quality and depth of their rotation and bullpen. I think the Blue Jays are well equipped for postseason success. They may not be on par. I know I'm belaboring this point. They may not be on par with teams like Atlanta or the Dodgers, but strange things happen in October. There's no reason this team can't win the World Series. And ultimately, frustrating regular seasons are very easily erased in collective consciousnesses by glorious Octobers.
They are also locked in, though, by inglorious Octobers. So
very much so.
That is on the radar as well. And you hit on a couple things there, Jonah. I think, you know, kind of there are a couple threads to this season. And one is that, yeah, at no point did they feel like a really great baseball team. And if you want to chalk that up to missed opportunities, whether it's 3 months as the worst runners in scoring position, hitting team, like they were headed toward being the worst playoff team hitting with runners in scoring position ever at one point. Now that's normalized a little bit. Missed opportunities in terms of, hey, had you even taken one against the Texas Rangers in that series? You head into this weekend nice and chill, and Kevin Gausman doesn't even have to bother with his visualization exercises. The other thing, though, is that all the story coming into this year was about the stylistic change that they were going to make. They were going to go from more of a boomer bust team, a team that relied a little bit more on the home run, to more of a run prevention team. Now, the way that has come out in the wash is that they are the number four team at the end of the season here in ERA. They're number seven in weighted runs created plus. So when we control for, you know, park factors and randomness and things like that in a batting line, they're still a top 10 offense, but not a top five offense. But they only finished 14th in runs. They only finished 16th in home runs. And there's an interesting clash here, Jonah, because traditionally we think of playoff baseball as, yeah, it's a run prevention game. It is a defense and, you know, base running and get to your bullpen and have a nice deep bullpen kind of game. But offensively, we know that historically, and especially in recent history, a greater share of offense comes from the long ball in the playoffs. You absolutely need the small ball elements and the run prevention elements, especially if you're holding a one run lead or you're trailing one run late. But by and large, more offense comes via the home run. So the primary question, I think, on today's reset day, Jonah, is yes, they finished the season as they did, more or less in line with how the last two went. They're in a good position here to take advantage of the fact that anything can happen in October. When you look at these changes and you look at the results of 162 games, Jonah, are they better equipped for playoff baseball than they were last year?
That's...
because it goes both directions, right?
It does indeed. I mean, yeah, the improvements or the increased depth and quality of their rotation is definitely offset by the fact that, you know, they just don't hit a lot of home runs. You look at the home run totals from the playoff teams, and the Blue Jays are clearly dwarfed in that department. And it is difficult because, as you mentioned, you know, against the elite arms you're going to see in the postseason, the ability to string together base hits is very greatly reduced. So there is much more of an imperative to hit the ball out of the ballpark, which doesn't exactly augur well for this team. You know, that hasn't been their recipe for generating offense really this year, which again, you know, came as a surprise, I think, to the entire fan base that expected them to continue mashing like they did in 2021 and 2022. But, you know, having said that, I mean, I don't think that it's, you know, impossible to see this team that has been the second best team with runners in scoring position since the beginning of September, you know, continuing to you know, string together some base hits in October and generate enough offense that their elite pitching staff, you know, when combined, you know, can make for a winning formula. So, yeah, I mean, historically, we know that, you know, it's teams that hit home runs that tend to overwhelmingly play deep into October. But, you know, a trend doesn't mean that, you know, that's the only avenue towards being successful. And, you know, I'm, you know, Blue Jays fans are obviously hoping that this team is going to be something of an outlier in that respect.
Yeah, the to use an old Dwayne Caseyism come playoff times on the Raptors side, there are many ways to skin more than one way to skin a cat. Now, I don't know why you'd use that particular analogy. I don't know why you're exploring different ways to skin said cat, but there are multiple ways to win baseball games. Okay, so we also, Jonah, now get to turn the page from, hey, everything that was a story over 162 is kind of refreshed here. Individual numbers get refreshed here. It is obviously related, and how we talk about this year's team will be based on, you know, how those things marry together. But for some guys who had a poor season, there is an opportunity to change that thought on them. For some guys who had a really good season, there is the opportunity to kind of waste that away. And then for us as people, you know, following this team, if you're a fan as well, and Jonah, I think I know your answer to this, but I'll put it to you. How much for you do you hit the clean slate or reset button in terms of your excitement and your anxieties and just the let's go of it all now that, hey, the regular season slog is done. It's playoff baseball.
Yeah, you have to smash that button, I think. You know, October is small sample theater, and crazy things happen in baseball over small samples. And moreover, like you said, this is an opportunity for, you know, the guys who underwhelmed this season to completely reframe their narratives for 2023. That's incredibly exciting. I don't really see how you couldn't be enchanted by the opportunity of a clean slate and of completely, you know, rewriting the story of 2023 over the next 4 weeks. You know, that's the thing, is that, you know, when we spoke, you know, a number of weeks ago, in early September, you know, I said 90% of the battle is getting into October, because once you do, anything can happen. You just have to get to the dance in baseball more so than in any of the other major sports. We know that, you know, the best teams, in baseball aren't, anointed champions nearly as regularly as they are in sports like basketball or football. So, you know, you have to be excited about this opportunity. And I also think you have to be excited about this opportunity because who knows how many more kicks at the can this core of Blue Jays players is going to get. I think that this season was, you know, perhaps a disquieting sort of harbinger of which direction this team is trending in. You know, George Springer's not getting any younger. Kevin Gausman's not getting any younger. Hyunjin Ryu is gone. You know, there's a lot of changes forthcoming to this roster. Matt Chapman's going to be a free agent in 4 weeks' time. So, you know, I think if you can't sort of ride the wave and get excited about, you know, this forthcoming playoff run, you know, you might be squandering an opportunity, because who knows what's in store for this group moving forward. So, yeah, absolutely. You know, you got to sort of just, I think, forget about the regular season. You know, this is a refresh, a reset, and get excited about the very real opportunity that this team has now to win a World Series and completely reshape its 2023 narrative.
And look, if you want to talk narratives, this is a Minnesota Twins team and fan base that is, again, to do the Jays at the Trop thing. The 2005 version of the Minnesota Twins has nothing to do with the 2023 version. They have lost 18 consecutive playoff games. There is a wild card loss in there and then a whole bunch of sweeps. They are kind of up against it here. Now, I would say that if we think of the 162 games as, you know, kind of an opportunity for iron to sharpen iron and you to find your stride and play your best baseball and things like that, the Minnesota Twins are at a bit of a playoff disadvantage in that they won 87 games in the AL Central, where we have an historic level of mediocrity this year. So they won two fewer games than the Blue Jays. Yes, they have a better run differential, but we're looking at a division where the next best team finished six games under 500, and that was a Detroit Tigers team that was weirdly like the best team in baseball in September. But a large part of that is because they kept playing Cleveland and the White Sox and Kansas City. The White Sox and Kansas City, both of whom lost 100-plus games. So there is a lot of noise to sort through in the Minnesota Twins statistical profile here. They played fewer games, and this is by a large margin. They played fewer games against teams that are 500 than any team in baseball. 20 fewer games against winning teams than the Toronto Blue Jays played. So I set this up not to wave the Minnesota Twins away entirely, because Jonah, they also happen to have been one of the hottest offenses over the last 6 weeks, converted a couple starters to relief roles and got a couple guys back healthy. They are a better team right now than they were, say, in June when the Blue Jays last saw them. But what do you make when you're evaluating the Minnesota Twins? And I think not just about their lineup, but the numbers that Cy Young candidates like Pablo Lopez and Sonny Gray have put up. How does the AL Central of it all affect your feeling on this Twins team that, you know, you could certainly make a case this is a good Twins team built for a short series the way the rotation lines up, but I would also completely understand if someone saw an 87 win team that feasted on, you know, arguably the worst division we've ever seen in baseball.
Yeah, it makes it very easy, very tempting to underestimate them. I think that that would be a mistake. In fact, I frankly think that they're extremely evenly matched with the Toronto Blue Jays. I think that their profiles, their identities are extremely similar. They're built on, you know, really effective starting pitching. They have kind of a dearth of star power in their lineup. But ultimately, I don't think that they should be taken lightly in spite of the fact that, you know, they play in the weakest division in baseball. You know, they still played above 500 against winning teams in 2023. You know, they may not have a ton of household names in their lineup, but they hit a ton of home runs this year. They were tied for third in the majors in home runs. They were fifth in the majors in isolated power. They had more players with double-digit homers than any other in Major League Baseball. So, you know, there may not be perennial all-stars in their lineup, but hey, Edward Julien had an amazing season. You know, Ryan Jeffers had a great season. Michael A. Taylor in his, you know, early 30s put up 21 home runs. So, you know, this is a lineup that it would be, I think, remiss to sleep on. And then, you know, you look at their starting pitching and it's really just excellent. You know, the weaker competition throughout the season, be damned. You know, by expected ERA, Pablo Lopez was the best starter in Major League Baseball. By FIP, Sonny Gray was the best starter in all of baseball. He had a lower FIP than Spencer Strider and Garrett Cole. And, you know, you look at, you know, sort of the numbers under the hood, they're not mirages. You know, this is an organization that I think has really done a remarkable job of identifying specific trends that they want to implement in their starters because they've been successful. You know, both Lopez and Gray have turned the sweeper into their primary off-speed offering to tremendous success. Pablo Lopez was a good starter in Miami for years before coming over. He has taken that to another level, I believe, thanks to the analytical and developmental savvy of the Twins. Same goes for Sonny Gray, who's been a good pitcher his whole career. But this year, you know, he led the majors in FIP, right? That's a significant jump even for him. So, you know, this is a good team. I think that, you know, structurally, they're very, very similar to the Jays. Talent-wise, they're very similar to the Jays. They should not be underestimated. And at the same time, they're beatable because the Jays are a good team too. You know, they have great starting pitching. You know, they have a lineup that on paper at least is very, very talented and in practice is solid at worst. So, you know, this is definitely, I still maintain, the preferable opponent given the Blue Jays demons at the drop and given that Tampa Bay, I believe, is just a superior team to Minnesota. But, you know, ultimately, it's not going to be a cakewalk. Like, yes, this is the preferred opponent, but, you know, there is some risk of 2 days from now us saying sort of be careful what you wish for because, you know, they may have, you know, emerged as sort of the token team from the AL Central, but I think it'd be a mistake to write them off because they're not a bad team.
Yeah, they're certainly not. You don't look, even in the AL Central, someone had to win, and someone had to win all those games against Central teams. And yeah, I think you said it well there, the analytics savvy side. And I know there are some Jays fans who don't like to hear that kind of stuff. But yeah, they took Pablo Lopez and helped him reach another level. The sweeper development there is fascinating, Jonah, because not only did he develop a sweeper, he was like the premier, oh, I'm a righty who can use my changeup to get righties out guy. And that's the pitch it's come at the expense of. And now he can kind of mix that in just as a show me weapon and use the sweeper for more swing and miss. We'll get it more into those matchups as the series rolls on, but they are a pretty dominant 1-2. And then if they decide to go the Bailey Ober route, he is a type of pitcher, one of those long extension down the mound, work the non-elite fastball up in the zone a lot type of guy that has flummoxed the Blue Jays a little bit. Yeah, they love a long extension down the mound guy there too. Okay, so Jonah, I want to do, we got a couple minutes left here. I want to do a gimmick that I've done in the past called Concern Index. And it's not meant to necessarily be negative, because your answer could be, I'm not concerned about that at all. In fact, I'm confident. Let's go. But it's called Concern Index. So I will give you an item and you give me a score from 1 to 5. 1 being, I'm not concerned about that at all. In fact, I'm confident. 5 being, if this comes up in a game, I'm going to curl into a ball. You understand?
Well, I'm going to start the game, presumably, in a ball.
Yes,
so,
I've watched playoff baseball with you before. This is we might have to grade this on a curve, but you get the general gimmick. Okay, so let's start here. Jordan Romano had a couple of blips in September. He had back-to-back games early in the month where he allowed runs. He had back-to-back games in the final week where he allowed runs. John Schneider used him in an earlier spot with Jordan Hicks in a de facto closer role on Saturday. What is your concern level with Jordan Romano?
2. I mean, you know, look, you look at the body of work for the season and for the last several seasons, Jordan Romano is one of the best closers in all of Major League Baseball. This year, even with, you know, a couple ugly performances there towards the end, 4 runs over his last 3 appearances, he still finished with a sub-3 ERA. His FIP was still below 3.5, and he only blew 4 saves in 40 opportunities. You know, obviously, you know, when a pitcher's dealing with something on their finger, it is concerning. I was encouraged by the fact that he looked really sharp, I think, in yesterday's outing. You know, he was hitting, you know, upper 90s with his velocity. It seemed like his slider command was pretty good. And, you know, ultimately, I think that, like, particularly that second outing against the Yankees, you know, that was one that just kind of got away from him. And the one against Tampa previously, when he blew the save in Tropicana Field, you know, he induced some weak contact, got a little bit unlucky with the batted ball placement. You know, they almost had a double play that got him out of the inning and would have completely reshaped sort of, you know, I think how we feel about him right now, and you know, mitigated some of the concern that some fans feel right now. But ultimately, I'm not concerned about Jordan Romano. He has been nothing short of excellent, you know, for the last 3 seasons as a Blue Jays closer. And I expect that, you know, those outings, you know, that have sort of, I think, incited a little bit of concern among Blue Jays fans. You know, that happens to relief pitchers from time to time. And ultimately, I think it would be wrong not to have faith in him moving forward.
I think that that is a fair summation of the situation. I think it's also, you know, if your concern is any higher than that, you also have the, well, there's Jordan Hicks and Eric Swanson around as well, both of whom, I mean, Jordan Hicks was asked to pitch 2 pretty tough innings the other day, so maybe you can look past that. Okay, Jonah, so we'll pivot to a starter here in Kevin Gausman. And Kevin Gausman, I personally don't put a ton into, well, you saw a team twice, and once they got to you pretty good, and once they didn't really, there is a bit of an oddity in that the Minnesota Twins were able to take 9 walks against Kevin Gausman over 10 innings in his 2 starts against them. So we'll make this item not just the Twins, but the fact that Kevin Gausman has the splits that he does against top offenses in baseball, where his ERA is about 3 points higher. The Minnesota Twins finishing the season 10th in runs and 7th in 6th in weighted runs created plus. Your concern level with that data point and the previous 2 starts between Gausman and the Twins?
Again, I think I'll throw a two out there. First of all, you know, the Twins, certainly this version of the Twins, I don't think that they're, you know, I don't think it's fair to characterize them as an elite offense. They're down Carlos Correa, you know, they're down Byron Buxton, you know, they're down Joey Gallo. Correa might return for the postseason, you know, for the wild card round. It does look like he might, but ultimately, you know, I don't know that it's fair to lump them in as an elite offense. And ultimately, I have faith in Kevin Gausman. You know, look, the Twins are a team that's very patient. You know, that their game is to take walks and then hit home runs with runners on base. But ultimately, Gausman has, you know, excelled in both those areas this year, even though the splits are a little bit more troubling against better offenses. You would expect them to be worse against better offenses. But he's a guy who ultimately does not walk a lot of batters, does not give up a lot of home runs. And that's the Twins' recipe for success. So, you know, I think it's a really good matchup for Kevin Gausman, especially given his ability to neutralize left-handed hitters with his splitter, because they do have you know, a fair number of lefties in Edward Julien, Alex Kirilloff, Max Kepler. I think this is a good matchup. You know, certainly as good of a matchup as you could have hoped for in the first round of the playoffs for the Blue Jays and for Kevin Gausman.
Okay, last one before I let you go here, Jonah. I know you've got an out. So Rocco Baldelli against John Schneider as the managing matchup. You mentioned the Twins have so many lefties. They pinch hit more than any team except I think Oakland this year. So they leverage that bench and the mix and match and platoon stuff more than anyone. Now, they also weren't particularly effective in quote unquote clutch scenarios. That's an area where the Blue Jays bullpen was among the very best in baseball when we, you know, when we control for the leverage of a situation and the outcomes there. Minnesota was a bottom 10 team on that side. But again, they do mix and match and tweak a lot. What is your concern level? Or if we want to flip it because you're optimistic, your optimism level with the John Schneider v. Rocco Baldelli matchup in this series?
My optimism level is probably a 4, I would say, because, you know, I think that my optimism is informed by the fact that the Blue Jays have the weapons to neutralize any kind of hitter. This is the deepest bullpen that they've had in recent memory, you know, and they have all kinds of different looks. You want a righty who throws triple digits and gets a lot of ground balls? You have Jordan Hicks. You have a righty who can neutralize left-handed hitters with swing and miss? You have Eric Swanson. You have a lefty who throws gas? You have Yenesis Cabrera. You have a lefty who gets ground balls? You have Tim Mesa. So, you know, they really have a look for any kind of hitter that Rocco Baldelli wants to summon off of his bench. And moreover, they have really good starting pitchers. So, you know, I think that, you know, it's easy to be optimistic about the Blue Jays' ability to match up and John Schneider's ability to match up because they have the weapons, right? You know, I think it comes down to, I have more confidence in the Blue Jays' bullpen than I do in the Twins' bench. So, you know, I think you have to feel good about it. And you know, moreover, like I said, you know, I think that their starters, Gausman, and whether that's Bassett in game 2 or Barrios in game 2, they're hopefully going to pitch deep into the game. And no matter sort of who Rocco Baldelli calls off of his bench, you know, hopefully their starter will still be cruising and you know, John Schneider can sort of keep his hands in his pockets and maybe won't even have to go to his bullpen. So they have the weapons, and that's really the reason, I think, to be optimistic.
I think that is, that's well said. Just very, very quickly, since I've got a minute left with you here, Vlad.
Look, you gotta love October, right? Because everything that happened over the preceding 6 months is irrelevant. It's a total reset. And look, no one needs one more than him. His at-bat quality over the last few days of the season was not good at all. You know, throughout, you know, the entire month of September, I was hopeful that he could get his OPS up to 800 for the season. That didn't happen. And now he's, you know, a half decade into his big league career, and he's had one season with an OBP above 350, one season with an OBP above, with a slugging above 480. You know, altogether, it wasn't a great season. Results-wise or process-wise, but that doesn't matter. At this juncture, it simply isn't relevant. You know, at this point, he's Vladimir Guerrero Jr. He's going to hit third for this Blue Jays team. You know, he's a 3-time All-Star who put up one of the most remarkable seasons anyone's ever seen from a 22-year-old in 2021. All of that takes on a lot more significance with a clean slate. So, you know, the optimism level is probably at a 2.5, I would say. You know, he has the potential and the ability to be a special hitter throughout the month of October and to carry this Blue Jays offense. We didn't see it over the regular season, but again, that doesn't matter. He's Vladimir Guerrero Jr. again, in the sense that, you know, anything is possible now. We know what his ceiling is. And the last 6 months were effectively spring training. So, let's see what he can do when the lights shine brightest.
Incredibly small sample, but 4 career playoff games, 369 OPS. He will be looking to improve on that. Jonah Bierenbaum of The Score, thanks for taking the time out this morning, buddy. Enjoy this week. Enjoy maybe this next month. Who knows?
Thanks, buddy. Same to you.
Jonah Bierenbaum of The Score. Make sure you're checking his stuff out at Bierenball on Twitter. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to take the national view of this series. We're going to talk to John Morosi. It was also a pretty big weekend around baseball. If you are someone of roughly my age and you see Miguel Cabrera signing off and Adam Wainwright signing off and what felt like a Zach Greinke sign off, what had felt like in the last home game, like a potential Joey Votto sign off, kind of feels like the first retirement class of guys that I've followed and rooted for from day one. That says something about my age and how old I'm getting. I also think there's something special in there where three of those guys I just named spent their entire career, or not their entire career, but the bulk of their prime years with one franchise. And John Morosi was down in Detroit to interview Miguel Cabrera for his last postgame interview on MLB Network. I will see how he felt about that. We'll set up all of these wildcard series with John Morosi as Blue Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Diving deep into Leafs, Raptors, Jays, and NFL. The JD Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. A little Minnesota pop punk for you to get you ready for these Twins as the Jays head down to Target Field for a best 2 out of 3 wild card series. All three games in Minnesota, 4:38 start times Tuesday and Wednesday. We'll see on Thursday. If there are 4 game 3s, then it'll be 4:38 as well, but that could bounce around. Someone who warned us last week that this Minnesota Twins team is a little better than the overall record might suggest, than your impressions of the AL Central the first 4 months of the season may suggest, was John Morosi of MLB Network. He joins us now. John, good morning, man. How was the weekend?
Outstanding, Blake. Was there with Miguel Cabrera yesterday in Detroit. Pretty special baseball occasion for the history of Detroit baseball and Major League Baseball overall. So a great Sunday, and actually Saturday I was up at an OHL game in Saginaw. So a good baseball hockey weekend for me.
Yeah, great piece from you on Michigan's Duke brothers, Dylan and Tyler, over at johnmorosi.medium.com. If anyone wants some of your hockey takes there. So you were a part of Miguel Cabrera's final game. He gets that final put out there, the first time he's even fielded a ground ball in a year, and a really nice post-game moment with him and the Tigers fans. It was kind of a week of that around baseball. We saw Adam Wainwright pinch hit. We saw him get a puppy from his wife because he'd said they can't get a puppy until he's done playing. We saw maybe goodbyes from Zach Greinke and Joey Votto. Those are guys who haven't committed one way or the other yet, but certainly their home fan bases made sure just in case to send them out on their way with a really nice final moment. What do you make of, and this is maybe me just speaking for me, but it does feel like that group of players signifies together, like if they are all retiring together, they're kind of the avatars for a certain era of baseball. And I wonder how much of that too is that most of those guys, if not all of them, spent huge chunks of their careers with one franchise. I guess to group them all together, how special was that part of this week in baseball? And what do you make of that group as, kind of a foursome, maybe even a fivesome, if you want to loop Brandon Crawford in there as well?
Right. No, it's a great point. And honestly, we're not even sure about Clayton Kershaw, who still has some playoff games to go. And that's one of the biggest names of all right now that we have to, I think, watch for this winter time. But you're right. It is the end of an era in a lot of ways. I think that you've seen how well this sport does ceremony and how many moments in a game, as with Cabrera yesterday in Detroit, where when you're really thoughtful about it, the way that A.J. Hinch and the Tigers were, that the game presents to you some pretty unique opportunities to honor people in this way and just storybook. And actually on the field after the game was over, I was there and AJ walked up to me and said, "You could go your entire career and not see something like that." Mm. And that's exactly right. In terms of just the way that it all lined up, the emotion of the day, it was a playoff-like crowd. Special. And I think it was the same way for Adam in St. Louis. And you think about what Zach Greinke and Joey Votto have done for the game. Terry Francona, certainly, in Cleveland in his last game as a manager yesterday in Detroit. A lot of emotions. And I can tell you this. I'm someone who tries to live day-to-day and not get too far ahead in the future, but I do know this, that when the Hall of Fame ballot arrives in 5 years, it's going to be pretty tough. You're going to have a lot of first ballot type guys or people like Adam Wainwright, who I believe are really deserving of the honor, who are going to make for a very, very tough ballot in that amount of time. If they all hit at the same time, it makes it a challenge for the voters. So we'll sort that out in due time. There'll be a time and place for us to have that conversation, but it really is remarkable the amount of talent that left the playing field potentially or definitely yesterday. And I think, too, it was interesting to be around Miguel yesterday. And as you point out, he didn't even take, as he told me after the game, he hadn't even taken a ground ball in BP all year long. And then he fields the one chance he gets in a game is just remarkable. But I think when you consider what this generation has meant, the uniqueness of all that they have achieved, and also the burden of being this great for this long. When Miguel was walking in the clubhouse yesterday, Craig Monroe from Bally Sports Detroit asked him how he was feeling, and Miguel's response was, "Free." Free is what he said, which was interesting. And I think it also speaks to how challenging it is when you're that great to have to live up to that standard every day for 21 years. It's hard. It's a hard job to do. You're doing it in front of everybody. Your numbers are measuring how good you are every day. And that's a lot. It's a lot to take. And I think Miguel said yesterday he felt free, and he looked it, and it was a pretty special way to converge a lot of appreciation and celebration all in one afternoon.
901 OPS he wraps up with, 511 home runs, just shy of 2,000 RBI. Really fun season for Cabrera to close it out here. You mentioned Clayton Kershaw could be a part of that group. We'll see. We'll read Andy McCullough's book on Clayton Kershaw when that's out later, after the final chapter here is written. Clayton Kershaw, of course, not getting to do those same things because he is in the playoffs. So let's pivot to the playoff side of things here, John. And I mentioned it off the top. We were kicking around potential matchups last week on this show with you, and you kind of pointed out, yeah, if you're sleeping on the Minnesota Twins because of the AL Central of it all, and the fact that, yeah, they won fewer games than any of the American League wildcard teams. That is true, but the quality of a team is not the same here in October that it was in, say, June. Why do you see this Twins team as a threat to the Toronto Blue Jays this week?
Well, first and foremost, they're going to see two guys who will appear on Cy Young ballots in the first two games of the series. And obviously, knowing how wild card series goes, sometimes those series only last two games. And you'll have to deal with Lopez and Gray. And the bullpen, I think, is better than people realize. The overall form of the team has been one of the best in the American League since September 1st. There, I think a lot of the ways on the position player side of the equation, it's going to depend on health. And if they are able to get back a fully healthy Royce Lewis and a fully healthy Carlos Correa, you know, in time, those questions just have to be answered with their play. I mean, there's a lot of unknowns right now. If all those things are clicking in the affirmative, they're a dangerous team. I think as talented as almost anybody else in the American League, really, if you ask me. But and also the other positive part of this for them is that they've seen guys like Quebec City's Edouard Julien and the Twin Cities' Matt Wallner, who has come in and played really well, guys that have had an opportunity because of the injuries. And so now you converge the emerging talents like Julien and like Wallner with the more established players, if they're healthy. And all of a sudden, Rocco Baldelli's got a lot of options because he's got guys that have been able to play, and then someone like Buxton, who is still, you know, even in a down year, the potential to be an electrifying player. I mean, if you were to tell me that Carlos Correa would hit 230, that Buxton would hit 207 and play only 85 games, like Gallo would be on the injury list as much as he's been, I would have thought this team would have been nowhere close to the playoffs, and yet they're in. So So I think Rocco Baldelli did a great job managing this club. They've had guys like Ryan Jeffers emerge and play really well. Alex Kirilloff, who I've always liked as a lefty bat. They're not a famous team, but they're a good team. And if they're all healthy, they could be a great team. And they're starting with two great starting pitchers, and I use the word great very intentionally. I mean, Gray and Lopez, look at their numbers. They've both been outstanding this year. So tough opponent. I think the Jays finally got the bats going. This is going to be, for me, one of the most intriguing of all the wild card series, and tomorrow likely to be the warmest game in the history of the Twins in the postseason in the Twin Cities. It's going to be a warm, warm game, which we typically don't associate with Target Field or the old Met Stadium in generations gone by. I mean, I covered some playoff games or a one-game playoff in Minnesota where there was snow falling outside the Metrodome. So that's what I'm more used to there at this time of year, and it's going to be in the low 80s Fahrenheit tomorrow, which I think will make it comfortable for the Jays and comfortable for Gausman, but it's going to be a really interesting setting for a ballpark that we typically associate with cold weather this time of year.
And it'll be terrific for fans. A lot of Jays fans, I would imagine, going down for those games since they normally do it for the regular season. I think there'll be a good Jays contingent there as well. John, obviously this version of the Minnesota Twins does not have anything to do with 2005 or 2012 or whatever other versions of the Twins. But you know, we've heard of this with the Seattle Mariners playoff drought. You know, here in Toronto, there was, of course, the Leafs first round issues until last year. The Raptors' inability to win game ones for a really long time and until the championship year. The Minnesota Twins have lost 18 consecutive playoff games. Considering that many of those series were not one game series, that feels almost impossible. Is there a specter of that? Like, do you think that is, it's certainly relevant to the fan base there, but that kind of thing doesn't bleed over into a room at this point in the year, right?
No, I would say zero chance. And maybe if they were playing the Yankees, it would be more of a topic. But because of the futility against the Yankees in the playoffs, and it's amazing to think the last, I'm so old, Blake, the last game the Twins won, I covered. It was 2004, game one at Yankee Stadium. It was actually the first playoff game I ever covered as a journalist. I remember I could recite the rosters and, young Joe Mauer there, all the, Justin Morneau was on that team, of course. I remember it well, 19 years ago now. But, to me, that history is interesting for us, but it's not relevant right now. And I think that the Astros, the last time that the Twins were in the playoffs was 2020. The Astros swept them in two games. There are some players still, maybe a third of the roster is still on that team from then. And so there is some institutional knowledge of it. But there's a lot of youth on this team as well. And Royce Lewis was not part of that group. A lot of the guys that have emerged that we're talking about were not part of that group. Sonny Gray was not on that team, nor was Pablo Lopez. That's all ancient history. I think it's actually interesting for me that both Gray and Pablo have had some playoff experience and had some success, actually, to where I put much more stock in that. Does your starting pitcher know how to handle the stage? And I think in the case of Lopez and Gray, they both do. And that to me is really reassuring if I'm the Minnesota Twins. So I think I look much more at the individual experience of those guys than I look at whatever happened when Francisco Liriano was facing the New York Yankees 13 years ago. I think it's not that relevant. And I'm really curious, though, to see, honestly, just what the home field advantage will be like for the Twins, how excited and engaged the fans will be there. Maybe you'll see a first pitch from a Morneau or a Mauer, and it'll be a pretty cool scene. So I'm excited about seeing what the atmosphere is going to be like, and the Jays are going to have to make sure that they bring the bats. I mean, that's the big question. Can you find a way to keep some offensive momentum going? Because the Jays pitch well, and they need to pitch well, and I expect that they will pitch well. They just have to find a way to get those situational hits to drop in, and then all of a sudden they could be on through the first round and beyond. But you're seeing two teams here with a lot to prove in October, and I can't wait. I think the Jays have a really good chance to win this series, but it's not going to be easy against a Minnesota team that I think a lot of people have really overlooked this season.
And, John, maybe a Johan Santana first pitch since he was the starter the last time they won a playoff game. You mentioned that these Minnesota Twins weren't on those rosters. Royce Lewis wasn't on that 2020 team, et cetera. The Blue Jays don't have as deep of a slump. They won playoff series as recently as 2016, but this core group was out in two games in 2020 in the expanded playoff format. We're out in two games last year. How much pressure do you think is on Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and Bo Bichette, who have been kind of the faces of this franchise on their way up, but in previous years had the, you know, hey, they're the young guys first experiencing this. It's more, you know, it's on them, but it's also on the more veteran guys around them. I would imagine, John, there is a decent amount of pressure on Vlad and Bo to perform in the playoffs this year in a way they haven't in their earlier cups of coffee.
I think you're right. And if I were to look at this objectively and say, based on where each team in this series is in their overall evolution and their win curve or their window, if you want to call it that, for which team would a loss be more devastating? It's the Jays, period. They are more in the heart of their window. They are the more expensive roster in terms of superstars and where it's all going. To me, this is a team that is leveraged to win right now. And if they do not win now, after all they went through to just make the playoffs, I think it'll be a huge miss. They need, obviously, and we've talked about this before during the course of the year, this needs to be a year where you don't just make the playoffs. You're supposed to be at the very least in the ALCS and probably in the World Series. This is the most balanced American League that I have seen in a long time. When those teams that have the acronyms of NYY and BOS are not in the playoffs, you need to see opportunity if you're the Blue Jays, if you're the Twins for that matter. But especially if you're the Jays in that division, you need to take advantage. And yes, Baltimore is a great team and is going to be great for a while, but you are more in your window to win than Baltimore is. Baltimore's got the better record, but this is more your year, if that makes sense. And so I think for that reason, there's a ton of pressure on Vlad and Bo. There is. They have to find a way to perform. And I think that when you consider the way the playoffs work and the art and science of managing pressure and tension during the playoffs. You saw it, I think, happen a bit with Julio Rodriguez down the stretch with Seattle. It's not easy. It's not easy when you're supposed to be the guy, but you're still relatively young in your career to manage the anxiety of the moment. And I think it got big for Julio at different times in the last month. The Jays cannot allow it to get big because while they're young still in the grand scope of a career, they've been around it long enough that they should not be surprised by how it feels. Both Vlad and Bo, one or both of them need to have a big moment, I believe, in this series for the Jays to find a way to advance. I don't see any way that it happens without them. They cannot be just part of the ensemble here. They cannot be passengers, if you will, on this trip. They have to be the leaders. And the game has a way of finding you when you are those players in October presenting you with those opportunities. And as much as you want to say you can't have, you know, the outcome of a full season and sort of decided by this small sample size of October, guess what? Derek Jeter's in the Hall of Fame for a reason, and we revere those performers in October for a reason. And the time now has arrived for Vlad and Bo to show it.
You mentioned the lights may be getting a little bright for J-Rod down the stretch there. Quickly before I let you go, John, Cal Raleigh, J.P. Crawford both making some comments as the Mariners were eliminated this weekend about the need for that front office to go out and spend a little bit more. They were an estimated 18th in baseball in payroll this year. What did you make of those comments? And do you think that Mariners ownership group and front office will heed that suggestion from a couple of their key pieces?
I think very fair and very measured. I know Cal walked it back a little bit the next day, but I think what he said in the moment was fair and was strong and was accurate. At the end of the day, when you look at the two teams that made it out of the AL West, and it was the Rangers who had went out there and spent on Seager and Semien, I realize the DeGrom deal hasn't worked out to this point. Eovaldi has been able to come back, and so he's a key guy. But they spent there, and the Astros have brought in veterans. And honestly, it's not even just the expensive veterans. You know, Michael Brantley won a game for the Astros down the stretch. And that, to me, was a crucial, crucial game in that time. Brantley is not a guy that makes $30 million. Brantley is, though, a veteran who knows how to win games in October. And that is something that I think the Mariners were lacking a little bit. They just weren't as deep as the other teams. And I think they'll look for a first baseman. Does it end up being Bellinger? Does it end up being, do you pursue Ohtani as a DH? They've got a chance at Ohtani. I still think that the Dodgers have the best chance. And I, for me, if I'm the Mariners, it's my job to really ascertain early in the offseason, do I have a legitimate shot at Shohei? And if I don't feel like I'm in there as one of the favorites, then I've got to move on and upgrade elsewhere and make my team competitive on the level of the Astros and the Rangers.
It's going to be a tough one for them on the outside looking in. If the Toronto Blue Jays don't extend past this wildcard series, going to be a lot of tough conversations and discussions here as well. But we'll hope that that's not what we're talking to you about next. John Morosi of MLB Network, of Blue Jays Central, thank you for taking the time out this morning.
Thanks, Blake. Enjoy the postseason, my friend. It is a wonderful time of year, and I just cannot wait for tomorrow.
Me neither, man. Me neither. John Morosi of MLB Network, of Blue Jays Central. JohnMorosi.medium.com if you want to see a little bit of his hockey writing as he was setting up the Michigan hockey season this weekend as well. A little bit of confusion for me as a college basketball guy, not a college hockey guy, to see him writing about the Duke guys at Michigan. But yeah, last name Duke, not college Duke. We're going to take a break. Let's dive into this matchup in a serious way. Let's, by the way, programming note, 10 a.m. tomorrow is when the wildcard rosters have to come out by. We're in the 10 a.m. time slot. Give you one guess what the opening segment is going to be tomorrow. Chris Black, producer at Sportsnet, is going to join us for this next hour, though. We'll try to figure out what that 26-man wildcard roster is going to look like for the Toronto Blue Jays. Maybe try to figure it out from the Twins side, but there are some known unknowns on the Minnesota Twins side with Joey Gallo, Royce Lewis, Jose Miranda, Carlos Correa, Nick Gordon, Byron Buxton, all on the IL on the position player side. At least four of those guys potentially returning at some point during the postseason. Right now, it sounds like Royce Lewis and Carlos Correa are the guys with a chance to be on this wildcard roster. It didn't sound like Byron Buxton was that close, but wouldn't he terrify you as a pinch hitter type off the bench? We'll see how all of that shakes out. Chris Black joins us next to do some roster machinations and start to dig in on this Twins matchup as Jays Talk Plus continues on Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Everything Raptors before and after the games. The Raptor Show with Will Liu. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Keeping it Minnesota on the tunes. Little replacements there for you. Can't hardly wait for the wildcard series to get going. Which 26 guys may be on the Toronto Blue Jays wildcard roster? I think we can guess a lot of them, but we're going to try to figure it out with Chris Black, producer at Sportsnet, at Down to Black on Twitter. Chris, good morning. Another great sweater today.
Thank you, as always. It's pure hoodie weather right now. It's peak hoodie weather.
It is going to be 30 degrees in Toronto
Doesn't
this
matter.
Week.
It's
not.
Mornings,
it is hoodie
cool.
calendar. It is not hoodie weather in
I
Toronto this week.
I force it sometimes, but yes, early in the mornings, it'll come off later.
And John Morosi was telling us in the last segment it's going to be like 87 in Minnesota at game time this week. This is unheard of for a Toronto-Minnesota playoff series. I know they haven't played each other in a very, very long time in the postseason, but yeah, it's not supposed to work this way. Climate change is real.
Here's an early, based on the game times, here's an early nugget I've heard already about this game time and in that park. Might be the worst park in baseball for daytime, mid, late afternoon, the shadows, all that stuff. So it could be good news. I know technically it's good for all pitchers. I feel like Kevin Gausman's fastball splitter discerning between those two, it might be a very good thing for Gausman. But all three games are going to be in that kind of area or in that time of day. So it could be a good thing for Gausman, but probably a tough thing for all hitters.
Yeah, and maybe some outfielders too. We'll see how those castaways. Although Rogers Center is not, you know, particularly uniform, and the Jays have played a ton of 3 p.m. games there, obviously, this year. I think Saturday and Sunday's game both had some weird shadow stuff going on. So, yeah, that'll be an interesting thing to watch. We are going to talk some Twins. We are going to talk wildcard roster. Before we do that, Chris, this is obviously a bit of a reset day. The 162-game grind is done. Obviously, that informs a ton of what we're feeling and what we're analyzing for the playoffs. But we do get to kind of put a pin in the slog of it. they've landed here with 89 wins. It's a few less than last year. They've come about it a different way. Fourth in ERA, seventh in weighted runs created plus, but only 14th in total runs scored. 16th in home runs is a big factor underneath that. So I guess before we get into the specifics of what this team will look like in the playoffs, what have you made of the regular season? We get a second to exhale here. Obviously, when we're living with it day in, day out, it can feel way worse or way better at times. And here they are at, I think Arden and I did the bit the one day of, if you went 4-3 every week, you'd finish with 90 wins, make the playoffs, and everyone would hate you. They went 4-3 every week, finished with 89 wins, made the playoffs, and at times they have frustrated just about everyone.
When I think about this Blue Jays season, I think what stands out is, and we've talked about this a couple times, but that they were able to make the postseason given what happened to Alek Manoah and given kind of Guerrero's, the numbers on the page still seem fine, but he didn't give you exactly what you thought. Given like some of the things that happened, for them to still make the postseason is a testament to how deep their roster is. And we've talked about this, getting contributions up and down the roster. To me, losing your quote-unquote ace, whether or not the nerds among us believe Kevin Gausman was the best pitcher on the staff, he was your ace. He finished top three in Cy Young voting, and you got literally nothing from him. And then to still
less
have,
than nothing. He finished the season with negative wins above replacement, exactly, which is the odd time where the metrics and the eye test, those have matched up swimmingly here. It's a 4.5 win swing if you use Fangraphs wins above replacement. And then, yeah, with Vlad, it's a 1.9. So even just your top young hitter, your top young pitcher, we're talking about a 6-7 win swing there in performance for those two.
Exactly. And if I were Pete Walker, if I were anyone kind of on that pitching staff, lab, whatever you want to call it, to me, to lose your top pitcher by performance, by whatever last year, and still have the best pitching staff in the AL, I'd be putting that right at the top of my resume and at the top, whatever, come contract negotiation time. But so it's been a slog. There are a few games worse than what we thought they would be. But when you consider what happened, just to make it into this, into the postseason dance is, to me, an accomplishment.
And they celebrated as such. John Schneider said as much that, you know, what are we doing here if you can't celebrate the 162-game grind and being on the right side of that? Arden and I talked about last week. And while I don't agree to quite the level of, yeah, the regular season should be the bigger trophy and the playoffs are just a fun tournament, this is a sport that for a very, very long time, the pennant was the big thing you were chasing. And then the World Series was like, cool still, but the pennant was the grind and what you were aiming for here. So Jays finished a little worse in the standing, in the record, than the last 2 years. But unlike 2021, they actually made it in here. And so the story of this season heading in was that we thought the Jays would be roughly the same caliber, maybe even better, but they were going to be different stylistically. Mm-hmm. They were going to focus more on run prevention. Now, they talked a little bit more about being versatile, more versatile offensively as well, which we took to mean a little less boom or bust, a little less reliant on, you know, hot streaks with the long ball. But they were going to focus more on run prevention. That has mostly turned out. Again, they have an argument for the best pitching staff in baseball this season, even after losing Alek Manoah. They finished fourth in ERA. And I guess the big question before we get into the specifics of this series is the idea was to get better. But failing that, the idea was, if we are roughly the same caliber, we will be better suited to win playoff baseball as a byproduct of better preventing runs and playing defense and doing the little things and things like that. The big drop off in homers, though, is the counter to that, because we know more runs are scored via the homer in the playoffs, significantly more. How do you come down on those things? Do you think this is a team that is a little bit better equipped for playoff baseball, a little less well equipped for playoff baseball?
I think they're better equipped for playoff baseball. I do think this idea of hitting home runs leading to wins, I get it. I understand it. It makes sense. But everyone's trying to me, it's less about, no one's going to hit a ton of home runs in the playoffs.
Right. And that, this is a good point, is if people don't sell out for the home runs, you just score a little bit less and the,
yeah,
you're not hitting more home runs. You're just getting runs in via three straight singles less.
Yeah.
Often.
And also like the magic stats, everyone takes what Arden has talked about recently, and which I fully agree with, like you need to hit more home runs than your opponent. That's true. But also like, it's usually like 1-0 or 2-1. So it's also about home run suppression. Like,
yes.
I know we talk about run creation and run, like, it's also about if you just pitch well and don't allow home runs, that can work. In that, that can help you win that ledger as well.
Yeah, if you allow zero home runs in a playoff series,
yeah,
I think you're going to win the home run battle and then probably the series.
Yeah, so I know we're simplifying it a bit, but like I do think they're better equipped. I do think part of what was lost in kind of they're bringing in Kiermaier and they're bringing in Varsho, defense for offense, all that stuff. But it was also just a redeployment of money. And like we don't, there's not a hard cap in baseball, but we know there's some budget somewhere that there's parameters that they need to operate under. And they turned, it wasn't just the money they saved on Teoscar and Gurriel. They didn't just turn into Varsho and Kiermaier. They also added Brandon Belt. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we kind of lose sight of that a little bit. And that's where I just think a guy like Brandon Belt, I feel like he's going to have a moment. I feel like he's going to have a postseason moment.
He certainly looked that way this week.
Yeah, he looks great this week. And that's always kind of when they grabbed him. I thought it was not a luxury, but just that's the kind of guy that they could, that this is the type of guy that can have a moment in the postseason where it is, you know, it can be with two runners on, flip the script and hit a 3-run home run. Like he's got that in his bag. So they have traded run creation for prevention. They've changed the outlook of their team a little bit, but they've also brought in a guy with some of that money that's been redeployed. They've brought in a guy who can still kind of do some of those things.
He has had 654 OPS in his career in the postseason, but some very high highs within that, including a 3 RBI wildcard game in 2014 and 2 rings. It should be said, obviously, you don't have to put up your 800 OPS.
Yeah,
in
not
the playoffs.
Very many people do.
No, you just got to, 13 playoff RBI is enough on its own. And a ton of walks as well. So he's a guy who, you know, we like him as a tone setter high in the lineup. We've talked about that a lot. Even if he's not one of your two best hitters, mm-hmm. having him in that spot can be helpful. Okay, last one before we and this is a very good pivot point, I think, to setting up this series. The Toronto Blue Jays played more games against good teams this year than almost anyone. That is a product of being in the American League East. That is a product of how the balanced schedule worked out. Now, obviously, strength of schedule is fluid, right? Not every team is the exact same quality every time you see them. We can't really control for that. What we can look at, though, is I believe the Blue Jays played 93 games against teams above 500. A team like the Minnesota Twins, for example, only played 73. The Twins played fewer games against 500 teams by far than anyone. And I mentioned this on air last week. You sent me the note while Dan Shulman and I were talking about the home road splits, mm-hmm. that the Jays' extra games against good teams happened to come at home just by the way the National League circuit, the schedule cycling worked out, where they, I think it was 8 extra games against 500 teams at home versus on the road.
I don't remember the specific numbers, but yeah, like it's what's interesting about the new schedule in that how you play half the NL on the road and half the NL at home is it's opened up a bigger variance in terms of the quality of your opponents at home versus on the road.
More balanced schedule league-wide, less balanced schedule home road.
That's right. So what's happened is, at least from the Blue Jays' point of view, actually for everyone, so if in the previous schedule, only about, I don't remember the specific numbers, but it's like only 10% of your schedule was different home versus road. Most of it was similar. So anything that was different home road, you could attribute it to some other random factors. This year, it's like 30% of the schedule is different, home versus road. And it just so happened to work out that a lot of the better NL teams and a lot of the better NL pitching teams came to the Rogers Center, and they faced a lot of the poorer teams on the road. Doesn't explain all of it. Like I said, it's only 30% of the schedule. But I think that does kind of tie into some of what we've been seeing home versus road for the Jays this year.
So the Jays are not going to cry American League East to Tampa Bay and Baltimore, no. who also saw a ton of really good opponents this year. Even the AL West, while the bottom was pretty weak, those three teams had to play each other a ton, especially down the stretch here. I don't know that we can feel too badly. You're going to have to play a lot of good teams. That is the way it goes. However, when you look at this series, a big question mark with this Minnesota Twins team. And again, the Twins are a good example of how strength of schedule is not a static thing for 162 games. The Twins team right now is better on paper and better by results than the Twins team we saw back in June.
Yes.
However, when you're evaluating things like the numbers that Pablo Lopez and Sonny Gray have put up, or the fact that they could start a lineup of nine guys who all hit double-digit home runs, how much of a factor is it for you that the Minnesota Twins played 73 games against 500 teams and nobody else played fewer than 85?
I think it's
a big factor. It's the worst division in the history of baseball, arguably.
Yeah, I haven't looked into whether it's the worst ever. It's certainly the worst this year.
I know Sarah Langs at MLB.com was tracking it for a while, and it was at one point, like because the AL East was the strongest division of all time, and I don't know where it landed. I can actually probably look that up because I'm sure Sarah Langs tweeted about it. But yeah, it is. They had 200 lost teams and no other competitive teams beyond Minnesota.
Yeah, this is where I kept kind of thinking about who the Jays would rather face, while fully understanding and acknowledging the Tampa injuries, the Tampa players who aren't there, the horrors at the drop. That's what I keep coming back to. In the softest division in baseball, Minnesota only won 87 or 88 games, whatever it is. They played so many poor teams, not only poor teams, and this ties into what you kind of alluded to with Gray and Lopez, but poor hitting teams who don't bring a lot to the plate, literally and figuratively. But I don't think they're super strong. I do think what you mentioned earlier is notable, is that they're different. They're better than they've been all year. They're deeper. Their bullpen's better. So they are. And it also is like everything I'm saying, and this is a classic line that Arden's used over the last couple of weeks, but like it also doesn't matter how much better I feel the Blue Jays are than the Twins. It's a 3-game series. We've seen the Kansas City Royals over the last month or two sweep teams that are much better than them in 3-game sets. Like at the most, you'd maybe tilt this series to like 53-54%. In Toronto's favor, maybe, but it's going to be a coin flip. That's what makes this stuff great, and it's also what makes it terrible and very nerve-wracking to watch.
It is certainly that. By the way, I did manage to bring up the stat from Sarah Langs that the AL East did finish with the highest winning percentage collectively in the division era, which goes back to 1969. They had a 554 collective winning percentage, which is, the highest of all time since 1969. They also had the highest winning percentage of any one division against the other divisions in baseball. So that's another, maybe notch in the favor of the Toronto Blue Jays here, or of all the American League East teams, since three of them are in the field here. But yeah, the AL Central was pretty on the dumps. Okay, we'll do a little bit more on the Twins as we go here. I guess before trying to figure out when to do a break here in this hour. Okay, so you mentioned that maybe the divisional thing pushes the Jays to say 53%. We know that in Major League Baseball, the winning percentage, because the sample gets so large, a home team's winning percentage is about 53-ish percent. That varies a little bit year to year and team to team, but we'll say 53% for lack of a better term. The Jays won a few more games than the Twins with a tougher schedule. The Minnesota Twins are slightly favored in this series. We won't go into the whole betting lines of it all, but it's close to a coin toss. But the Minnesota Twins are slightly favored. Does that surprise you?
Not really, because like I said, I feel like Toronto's slightly better. And as you mentioned perfectly, that the home advantage is a little bit probably neutralizes that almost entirely, if not more. They're playing pretty good. They have a really good pitching staff. The starting pitching matchups in this series, it's outstanding. Yeah, like to me, it's a coin flip. So whether it's a slight favorite or not, I'm not too concerned about that. But yeah, that tracks for me. The road team's slightly better, but if this was an NFL game, you're giving a field goal to the home team. So yeah, that makes sense.
And the game one odds are dead even. Kevin Gausman against Pablo Lopez. So a slight bet there maybe on Sonny Gray versus whichever of Berríos or Bassett it is.
That makes sense.
And then, although I think game three, I would lean toward Bassett or Berríos whether it's Joe Ryan or Bailey Ober.
I would lean, I think Gausman, I think the Jays in game one are probably the biggest favorite of any of those three games. I like the idea of Gausman, even knowing all the troubles he's had against this particular team.
Yeah. 9 walks in 10 innings over 2 starts.
There's a lot to digest. I don't know if you want to do this now or later, but Gausman against the Twins, there's just a lot to digest.
Let's do it right now. We'll do the roster stuff in the second half of the hour.
Yeah, so Gausman, what stands out with him is he's faced the Twins 4 times in the last 2 years. And, like, we've seen this a couple times throughout his tenure with the Jays, but not getting chase on the splitter down in the zone, it always brings up, is he tipping? Is somebody tipping? That's another aspect that I'll get to in a second. But essentially, the Twins have laid off his splitter more than any other team that he's faced, at least more than once. So he's pitched 62 games in the last 2 years. And, like, his 6 worst games in terms of generating chase on the split, 3 of them came against Minnesota, 3 of the 4 games that he's played Minnesota. So it's a weird, you can go into a bunch of different things with this, but is he tipping? Is he not? Is he too predictable in terms of fastballs up versus fastballs up and splitters down? Is it just a really good approach from some really patient hitters? I did a bit of a preview today that I've sent out to a bunch of guys that we work with. And maybe the craziest stat that stands out to me is Canadian Edouard Julien has seen 35 pitches from Gausman, and he's swung at 5 of them. He has taken 30 of 35 pitches against Gausman. So it'll be very interesting to watch. Now, there's some people who think he was tipping. There's some people who think maybe the catcher might have been tipping in some of these occasions. This is something that comes up more than you think. It needs to be early enough, but some catchers, regardless of even talking about Gausman in particular here, some catchers will set up differently if it's a fastball versus a splitter in the dirt. And if you give that away too early, if you become predictable, and if you give away your kind of setup early, someone, whether it's a guy in the dugout, somebody on the bases, a first base coach, a third base coach, a base runner, somebody can tip that off to the hitter. So it might be that, might be nothing, might just be a good game plan, but the Twins have really done a good job at laying off essentially what is one of the most difficult pitches to lay off in all of Major League Baseball.
And it's a weird one because you'd think if it was a dramatic tip, more than just the Minnesota Twins would pick up on it, right? And we've seen teams get to Gausman in different ways, but it's not like the Twins are such an extreme example of laying off the splitter that, you know, obviously if there was something mechanically and a team saw the Twins have great success against Gausman, every team would be on top of that quickly. It would be too coincidental for it just to have been figured out. And then not until he sees the Twins again, does he start tipping that thing. Because again, you mentioned 3 of the bottom 6 games in terms of chase on his splitter. So it's a fascinating one. We could dive in. The catcher thing is really, really interesting because obviously if the Twins have a super savvy, say first base coach or I guess third base coach with how lefty heavy they are, maybe something there. It'll certainly make it worth watching Alejandro Kirk, who has caught Gausman a ton, so you'd hope that they have figured some of that out as well.
The other thing that stands out to me is if it was just a good approach against these types of pitchers, then you would suspect that if you looked at other pitchers or even guys on the Jays who have a similar profile, and the two guys that stand out to me are Swanson and Trevor Richards, who it's a changeup. But essentially, it's fastball up and a changeup that moves like a splitter. And both those guys have been lights out against the Twins. I looked at others. Here's one of the challenges is there's not very many starters who throw a lot of splitters. But Alex Cobb is one of them. He's made 2 starts against the Twins in the last couple of years, and he's been good. So it feels like they might have something. It might have also just been something on one particular day or 2 particular
days. Because Gausman did have 1 really, really good start mixed in there with the 3 iffier ones.
Yeah, so it might have just been something on one particular day. And also it might just be something where it gets in your head, you're worrying about it, and it just kind of snowballs. And it might not be an issue tomorrow. Like we said, it might be hard to pick up the splitter tomorrow because of those shadows we were discussing. So who knows? But it's, to me, that is maybe like top of the list of what I'm going to be looking for tomorrow is what are they doing against his splitter?
And I do think that if you are going to identify a team that might be able to execute and stay within this approach against Kevin Gausman, it might be a team like the Minnesota Twins, where they're a high walk rate team. So, you know, they're a group of guys that has some good selectivity at the plate. They lead the league in strikeouts. So they're not a team that is afraid to, you know, hey, if your game plan has you down in a count and you're at two strikes, so be it. They are more than willing to accept strikeouts as a cost of their approach at the plate. They are also a heavy home run hitting team, and all we've heard for the last couple of years about how Minnesota is trying to develop hitters is about lift and launch angle. It's you want to get the ball up, and even if you are not the most powerful guy, you want to go Isak Paredes, Davis Schneider of just make sure you hit the ball in the air then, because better things can happen if it's in the air. And if you're against Kevin Gausman and that splitter, and you are someone who it likes to take a walk and be selective, is okay getting behind in a count because you're not going to get chastised for striking out, and your approach at the plate is about finding something you put some lift into, those three things would all point in the direction of, well, maybe you lay off the splitter. It still takes an immense amount of discipline to identify it and execute it, but a team that is so reliant on lift and is so walk and strikeout heavy, to me, is the type of team that might be able to stick to a plan like that.
Yeah, I fully agree. Just the part that is wacky to me is like the Swanson and Richard stuff.
Yeah.
And it might be Swanson throws his splitter in slightly different ways.
You also just might be way more prepared for a starting pitcher than you are for a reliever.
For sure. I do think Swanson, he will throw his splitter almost like high sometimes, like up in the zone, almost like belt high. It feels super dangerous when he does it, but he has success with it. So Gausman really doesn't do that often. Like, even if he's throwing it for strikes, he is almost always in that one little quadrant, kind of arm side down and away to a lefty, where even if it's quote-unquote in the zone, it's barely in the zone. So that could lend itself to explaining some of these things, that where if they're so focused on lift and focused on – that would mean they're kind of focused on pitches – up belt high, stuff like that. So that makes sense. But like I said, it's top of the list of what I'm going to be watching for early in the game.
This is a look ahead to game two or game three. But while we're on pitchers and how they might play against the Minnesota Twins, earlier this year, I would have been worried about Chris Bassitt going up against a Minnesota Twins team that, as of right now, has six or seven lefties on their roster and has a team full of guys who can hit the long ball. Because earlier in the year, Chris Bassitt was struggling with the long ball, struggling with lefties. He gave up two home runs in a 7-run, 4-inning game against the Minnesota Twins back in late May. That is around the point, though, Chris, that Chris Bassitt made a shift in how he was attacking lefties. Where did those numbers end up for the year if you don't have them handy? Where is your confidence level? Where did that end up in terms of Chris Bassitt facing a powerful lefty heavy lineup? Because this is one of those things where, like, sometimes splits can be random and we're drawing our arbitrary lines. But in this case, there was an explanation for why things would maybe change.
At least a partial explanation. We don't know the full story, but we talked about this Joe Siddle did on Blue Jay Central last week during Bassitt's last start or during the pregame show. But essentially, he was getting burned by trying to get cutters into lefties and just not executing that pitch perfectly. And his stuff, and we've talked about this throughout the year, like, his stuff isn't great. And I say that as like a compliment to him, where,
yeah, I mean, he just pitched 200 innings with a sub-4 ERA.
He pitched great. And neither, like, there's these metrics and this stuff that'll measure the quality of every pitch that every guy throws. And his stuff doesn't grade out very good. But what he does is he locates, he can mess with pitchers' timings. I almost used a different word there. He messes with hitters' timings, and he's a really smart pitcher, and he can locate, and he can mix people up. He can speed bats up, slow them down. But what he did, it was the cutter giving him issues against lefties, trying to work it into them, getting too much of the plate, not getting it up enough, and they were hitting that pitch, driving that pitch. And what he kind of did, he still does go in. Like, it's not a drastic night and day change, but he started throwing that cutter away, almost like a backdoor cutter up and away to lefties. And it's just a pitch that, to be honest, I don't think they see very often. And it just messes I think that's what he does more than anything. If you're a hitter, it's just he'll do things to you that you just don't see very often. Mm-hmm. 68 mile an hour curveballs and just weird sinkers up in the zone, cutters away to lefties. So he does weird things. Super smart, great pitcher. But yeah, he kind of primarily changed where he was most often throwing that cutter to lefties, and it's kind of been the driver, I think, to his success against lefties in the second half of the year.
And semi-related to that, he has trimmed back his usage of pitches that break horizontally to lefties, because generally those are the type with more platoon splits. So if you're righty, something that is breaking in toward a lefty, or even a two-seamer kind of comes back into the bat path or something like that.
Yep.
So yeah, he's traded those out in favor of more vertical breaking pitches, or in the case of his four-seam fastball, a bit more of a flatter pitch overall. We'll dive into that more ahead of game two or game three, whichever game Chris Bassitt ends up starting. We know who the three starters will be. We think we know who the three starters will be. It would be a major surprise if it isn't Kevin Gausman, Jose Berríos, and Chris Bassitt in some order. What does that mean for Yusei Kikuchi? What does that mean for Hyunjin Ryu? What does that mean for other guys on the roster bubble? Let's take a break. Try to come up with a 26-man wildcard roster as Chris Black stays with us on Jays Talk Plus on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Your daily dose of everything NFL. It's the Fan Checkdown with Matt Marchese and Donovan Bennett. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. That's a song called Day Drunk. Maybe that's where you're going to be with these 4:38 wildcard starts. Tuesday at Target in Minnesota. Wednesday, 4:38 as well. Thursday, we'll see. If there are four wildcard games, it'll be 4:38. Also, programming note, we'll be with you 10 to 12 no matter what, every day for the whole week, whether we're breaking down win, loss, game three, set up the ALDS, close the book on the season, whatever. We're here with you 10 to 12. Blair and Barker will bounce around a little bit as needed around those game times. They are 5 to 7 today if you're looking for them. Also, as I'll mention on the way out here, Raptors show with Will Liu and Alex Wong coming to you live from Raptors Media Day after we're done here. That starts at 12 o'clock. They'll be joined at some point during that program by OG Anunoby, by Jakob Poeltl. Beyond curious to see how my future co-hosts do with a 15-minute block with OG Anunoby. It's also media day down at Target Field as media assembled, get ready for this series. None of that stuff is taking place until later this afternoon, but we'll hear from John Schneider and Rocco Baldelli and get some injury updates and things like that. We don't think any injuries are going to impact the Toronto Blue Jays roster. They are healthy with the exception of Danny Jansen, who is not in the mix for this or really any series soon, we don't think. There are still some tough roster decisions to make, though. Chris Black of Sportsnet, a producer on the Blue Jays broadcast and Blue Jays Central, is still with us. He's at Down to Black on Twitter. Chris, let's do a roster. Let's come up with a wildcard roster. We've talked about it a couple times over the last couple of weeks. My rule was if the Jays are in a playoff position the morning of that show, we could talk about playoff stuff. If not, it wasn't allowed. So we talked about it a little bit. We have a couple locks here, right? We know Kevin Gausman, Jose Berríos, and Chris Bassitt are going to start in some order with almost certainty.
Yes.
You don't think there's... Okay,
100% certainty.
Okay.
99.
That is good. So those are locks. We also have a pretty good sense of who the starting nine are going to be. Minnesota only employs right-handed starters. We saw the Blue Jays in every meaningful game this week use the same set of nine with some juggling of the order. But last we saw it, George Springer, Brandon Belt, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., Bo Bichette, Kevin Biggio at second base, Alejandro Kirk, Kevin Kiermaier, Matt Chapman, Dalton Varsho. Those nine are in.
Yep.
Let's do the position player side first. So those nine are in. Tyler Heineman's a lock, because you got to have a backup catcher, not just for injury insurance, but there are a lot of scenarios where you could potentially run for Alejandro Kirk.
Yep.
So that's 10.
Whit Merrifield lock.
Whit Merrifield is a lock as kind of a super sub.
Yep.
Wouldn't be entirely surprised to see him get a start here and there, whether it's over Varsho, whether it's over Biggio. He would be the next starter up. Also has some utility. He has some experience as a pinch hitter. I believe he has 13 pinch hit appearances in his career. He's 0 for 5 this year, but he has some familiarity with it. Also a guy who's not a bad base runner. So in a scenario where you don't have Cam Eaton on the roster, he's probably your number one pinch running option. We will play that out in a second. So we put Merrifield in the lock category. There are three guys now for two spots or for three spots.
Correct.
Davis Schneider, who was looking like maybe he was in rough shape for, hey, could you really trust an 0 for 31 streak in a pinch hit situation, went bonkers yesterday. He did his thing where once a week he gets to play, he has a big game. Santiago Espinal, who, as Dan Shulman broke down on the broadcast last night, hasn't had a lot of opportunity during this two-week stretch with no lefty starters. But if we chop up a small sample over a long stretch of time, has hit a little bit better. We know they trust his defense at second, third, and short, even if the metrics haven't loved him this year. And then there's Cam Eaton, who we saw pinch run a bunch but did not see steal a base. So those three guys, potentially for two spots, possibly even for three spots. Let's start with this. If they go 13 and 13, so only two of those guys are making the roster, who do you think is the odd man out?
I think it might be Schneider, who I've loved watching play. I've loved watch hit over the last couple months. I just feel like there are some redundancies with Merrifield, Espinal, and Schneider all on the roster. I'm not sure you would go to Schneider ahead of Merrifield, let's say, in a pinch hitting situation in the postseason. And that isn't, I'm not even making an argument about who's a better hitter right now. I just, a veteran versus a rookie. Espinal brings more to the plate defensively than Schneider, the ability to play shortstop. So it really becomes an Eden versus Schneider question. And to me, when you've got Belt, Kirk, and Guerrero on your roster, I think you need a designated pinch runner guy, more so than you have in the past. I know those three guys were on your roster last year, and they didn't bring Zimmer, so maybe that informs some of the discussion. Maybe he won't. I do think, like, this is what you have to do on the Monday before a postseason roster. Like, these are the things that we need to talk about.
But it's also worth noting with Zimmer, there was even more of an argument to keep Zimmer last year because the outfield defense was not as strong. And I'm not saying that if Bradley Zimmer is a defensive replacement in that game, George Springer doesn't take a knee to the head on a wonky collision or whatever. But there was extra argument. Like, the argument against Cam Eaton would be, well, if it's a close game, you probably don't want to take one of your top defenders. There would still be the pinch run value, obviously, but there is no longer a case of, well, also his defensive replacement value, because even though he's a good outfielder, and by all accounts a great outfielder defensively, you wouldn't be substituting him in just for defense like you could have for Bradley Zimmer over Gurriel or Teoscar last year.
Yeah, and there were some redundancies in that world last year because you had Jackie Bradley Jr. on the roster last year. But it's interesting because they have some guys who aren't so fast on the bases, it makes them, A, more likely to maybe need Cam Eaton, but also it also makes you more likely to need that extra roster spot, which is where I saw Ben Nicholson-Smith and a couple other guys
wrote it. Shai Davidi and David Singh, they did a round table,
and they all did the 14-12, which I fully get, but also I know how much this team values pitching. Mm-hmm. And that's, they went 13 last year, so they all predict that the team is going to change what they did last year. They might be right. I'm not sure.
Well, they won last year, right? So they should stick with that.
No, we're not discussing last year. I'm not sure, but if they go 13, for some reason, I feel like Eden will make the roster, and I feel like Schneider might be the odd man out.
That's a tough one from a pinch hit against a good lefty value. The other thing to keep in mind is, you know, most relievers, and especially on this Minnesota team, throw gas. And if there's a, you know, something you might pick at with Davis Schneider, it is the ability to handle that. But that's also the case for a lot of guys on this team.
Yeah, I literally put that in my preview sheet that I wrote today that I sent to you guys. Like,
I have not seen it yet.
He's a good pinch hitting option against high velo. So, like, there's no right answer and there's no wrong answer. Like, it's a matter of what they choose to value. If they choose to value pinch hitting and flexibility, then they'll go Schneider over Eden. If they really want both, if they think they're going to be making a lot of moves, then they're going to go 14 and 12. But I'm interested in whether they go 14-12 versus 13-13. That's kind of what I'm interested to see tomorrow morning.
My guess is they go 14-12, but only for the wild card series. If they make it past that, you're going back to having the extra bullpen arm. So this is a wild card series discussion only because you only have three games. And, you want to have a lot of relievers available to you, and you can't predict what's going to happen with your starters. You certainly couldn't predict that Kevin Gausman and Alek Manoah last year wouldn't give you a ton of length. We have Kevin Gausman, Jose Berríos, and Chris Bassett written in as starters. I think the bullpen locks, and correct me if any of these guys strike you as non-locks, Romano, Hicks, Swanson, Garcia, Meza, I'm including Cabrera, given how lefty-heavy Minnesota is, and given the way they've talked about him and used him, I think if Chad Green's not a lock, he's close to it. Would you agree with that?
I would.
Which means there would be, if they're carrying 14 guys, 14 position players, that bullpen would mean there is one spot left for... two spots left for Kikuchi, Ryu, Richards, Francis, whoever.
Those four,
pick if you want to make an A. Pearson case. I don't think it's very strong, but
to me personally, I'd view Kikuchi as a lock. Again, for the same reason you kind of mentioned Cabrera, he's got a comfort or an ability at least to come out of the pen. So I think that makes him a lock.
He should be, to be clear.
Yeah, so do I. So then I think it comes down to one spot for three guys if you're going 12. And that becomes an interesting discussion. Richards was so, so good early in the year. He hasn't been good for the last little while. But I don't think you'd want to expose him in a lot of leverage, and I don't think you'd want to expose him for more than maybe even just one batter. But if it was if you had to pull a starter in the fifth inning of a game with two runners on and you needed a strikeout and you didn't want to go to necessarily one of your top guys, he can still strike a guy out as good as anyone. So as good as Bowden Francis has been, and I love his outlook for 2024, I'm not sure in this scenario that they would go Francis over Richards. Again, one of those things where I understand the viewpoints. I wouldn't disagree with you if you chose Francis over Richards. But I think the value of his ability to strike guys out and kind of a tip of the cap to what he's done for your team all year long. It's a weird, this recency thing. I don't even want to call it a bias because I don't think it's bad logic to tilt more towards
especially with relief pitchers.
Yeah, like it's good sound logic to go with the guys who are hot in the moment. But I also just think it's funny that if his bad month was in April, that we'd be viewing this in a whole different way. But still, I think I would lean Richards. I don't know. What about you?
I think that's probably what they're going to do. I think the case for Bowden Francis would be a little extra length. And I think the counter to that would be, well, he hasn't pitched in a competitive game in a little bit. And also, what scenario are you getting into where you use a length guy versus just turning to your actual bullpen arms early? Because every game is such a must win. If you even, say a starter gets chased in the third inning or something like that, in a game like this, are you not just going firing six relievers at it?
Yeah.
Like, do you need a length guy? And is Kikuchi not that length guy if you need it?
I think the only spot where a guy like that really comes into play is if you're tied in the 11th or 12th and you're like literally out, not fully out of arms, but you need someone to potentially give you two or three.
And then the argument there could be, well, then you should carry 13 pitchers if you're worried about that scenario.
That's where I'm not sure, like everyone you're saying, you think you'd go 14 position. Everyone in that piece said 14. I get it. It feels like 14 is like the overwhelming choice. And maybe it is, maybe that's what it winds up. They feel like a pitching staff organization, if that makes sense. So I wonder if they're going to go 13 again.
But it's also, don't you really, really trust your guys? Which is the counter to that. Okay, so if they go 13 and 13 then, the question then becomes, okay, Richards is in. Is it Bowden Francis or do you try to find a relief role for Hyunjin Ryu?
Yeah, I wondered about that. In a week or so ago, I probably would have said Ryu. But
two rough ones in a row.
He really doesn't have, like, literally the spot where you would use reuse if you needed, if you're in a spot where you needed a ground ball or again, that extra inning thing. But to me, he has one relief appearance in his entire major league career. And literally I looked up like the clips and the, what Dave Roberts said in the moment, what Ryu said. And it was like the Dodgers had a really deep rotation and he literally wasn't pitching well. So they said, yeah, he might come into the bullpen for a while. And after that game, he pitched great. It was like three or four innings. He actually got a save. It was one of those three or four inning saves. And Robert said he has one of the most meticulous pregame routines I've ever seen. And Ryu said, in my heart, I'm a starter. And then he was back in the rotation and never went back. So I don't think it would be Ryu. That just makes me think that he's either going to wind up as a starter in one of these rotations, or he might have pitched his last game for the Jays.
He may have. And we'll see. Obviously, the longer this goes, the more opportunity there is for wanting a fresh arm or someone getting hurt or something like that. I think if he's not on the roster, he's going to be a big part of that clubhouse and dugout still. We're running out of time here, so let me throw one more at you. Ricky Tiedemann's supposed to be at the Arizona Fall League right now. He's in Buffalo. He's part, last update we heard, or I heard personally, was that he was still in Buffalo with that extended taxi squad. Now we'll see. Today is the opener for the Arizona Fall League. They don't really announce starters ahead of time and things like that. So we'll see. We'll see it. The surprise Arizona. I'm not making a surprise joke. That's the name of the team that the Jays players are on. We'll see. I thought it was a little interesting that he was still in Buffalo.
I literally wrote in last February or March that he could get big league lefties out that like right now, like his fastball, his mix of fastball, breaking ball and change up less so for lefties, but this crazy arm slot that he uses, he can get lefties out. I don't think that this would be the time he would make his major league debut, but I love the idea. I love where your mind's at.
I just look, I'm not suggesting they do it. I'm not suggesting they're leaning that way. But when I heard multiple times last week, once from John Schneider accidentally, and then once from something else that might've been accidental, that he was still in Buffalo. My eyebrows raised a little bit. That's all. Yeah. I mean, if Orion Kerkering can do it, there's obviously the K-Rod example of no one's seen this guy before come up and throw a 40% strikeout rate playoffs. Look, I'm not saying it's going to be that. I'm not saying they're going to try it, but it's at least it's a note in my notes sheet.
Love it.
Is all.
This is what you hit at 11:50, right? Last 10 minutes of your show or 5 minutes. Like, love it. Absolutely love the content. The producer in me is absolutely loving that idea. Loving how you threw that in there. I don't think it would happen. But it made me step back and go, huh.
Yeah. There will be other guys with the Blue Jays as a taxi squad as well, or satellite camp, whatever you want to call it. Wes Parsons is probably headed back there. Jay Jackson was still with the team during the celebration yesterday. There are some weird roster possibilities where he somehow finds his way back in down the line as well. I don't think that's particularly likely, but the Twins just did that with Jordan Luplo not long ago. DFA'd him. He agreed to be outright assigned a second time, and then they added him right back to the 40-man. Weird stuff happens. This is why, as Mike Petriello likes to remind everyone, the August 1st deadline to be on the 40-year is fake. The September 1st.
A deadline in name only.
Yes, August 31st, rather. Deadline is there are loopholes, and then there are loopholes to the loopholes. Chris Black, producer at Sportsnet, thanks so much for taking the time this morning, man.
Anytime.
Thank you to Chris, to Jonah Bierenbaum, and to John Morosi for coming on. Again, we'll do a quick programming note here that today is media day for this series. So you'll get a lot of quotes and social media content, a lot of articles at sportsnet.ca later on today. We'll pick and choose through that stuff tomorrow. I don't know that we'll play you a ton because it'll be a little stale at that point. But if you're looking for more Jays content from the Jays side when they're not soaked in champagne and beer, keep an eye out for all of that a little later from down at Target Field. Blair and Barker are going to have you for 5 to 7 today to continue to set this series up. The rest of the way, their time slot will flex around a little bit because these games are at 4:38 on Tuesday and Wednesday and potentially Thursday. We will be with you 10 to 12 no matter what. And in the coming days, we'll have kind of wall-to-wall Jays setup content. So JD Bunkus is going to be 12 to 2 tomorrow. I'd imagine that show will have a little bit of other stuff, but it'll be heavy, heavy on Jays. Show Ali and Ben Shulman will have a Jays talk lead-in for you. And then, of course, Blair and Barker whenever those games end. Today, though, Will Liu and Alex Wong, the Raptor show, are coming to you next live from down at Toronto Raptors Media Day. They will be joined at some point in the program by OG Anunoby and Jakob Poeltl. They will not be joined by me because the Toronto Blue Jays are in a wild card series. A little jealous they get to talk to my guy OG without me. But if you've been keeping an eye on Raptors Media Day stuff, if you haven't been keeping an eye on it and you just want Will and Alex's kind of wrap on what the tone of the day was, this will probably be a very, very fun 2 hours from them live on the Sportsnet Radio Network and, of course, on the Raptors Show podcast feed later. The Toronto Blue Jays wildcard roster will be out around 10 a.m. tomorrow morning. We'll be back with you then to break it down and continue to set up Jays Twins wildcard.